The new Portals of Prayer devotional Bible is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. This devotional resource contains the entire English Standard Version of the Bible with 700 devotions from Portals of Prayer. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or learn more about Portals of Prayer devotional Bible by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Portals of Prayer devotional Bible.
If the pro-lifers had had their way, America would be a browner and blacker place than it is today. And the progressive people who have had their way on abortion ever since Roe v. Wade are creating a whiter America.
People will say, well, we need to be merciful people. We need to forgive Carson King. We should very much avoid saying that we need to forgive him, because all that does is legitimize the mob.
The church is not an abstraction. It's a real place. And that is, of course, necessary because of the way the Lord meets us. He meets us in his word and sacrament. He meets us through physical means, and that means we have to have a place to go to receive them.
If I take a practice from, let's just say, a Baptist church, and I incorporate that into a Lutheran church, I'm actually incorporating a Baptist practice that is birthed out of Baptist theology.
This is Ezra from Louisville, Kentucky. And my mom loves Issues Etc.
And my mom loves Issues Etc.
When you think about American history, especially back to the roots of American history, the colonial and the revolutionary period, you can think about religious groups that were there in the colonies. You think about Baptists, you think about people from the Church of England, the Quakers, and others. But you don't usually think about Lutherans. Were they there? Do they have a significant role to play, not only in the American landscape as it was forming up, but also in the times of colonialization and the times of revolution? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, October the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to spend some time with Dr. Larry Rast talking about 18th century American Lutheran pastor Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, remembered on this day in history. A little bit later, listener email, the Issues Etc. comment line. Then Pastor Brian Wolfmiller joins us for our ongoing series, Introducing the Books of the Bible. We'll talk about the Gospel of John. Joining us to remember 18th century American Lutheran pastor Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, Pastor Larry Rast, President and Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Larry, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. It's great to be with you.
Lutheran is not the first name that pops up when we think about the colonial and revolutionary period of American history. How would you correct that, if at all?
Well, you know, amazingly enough, just last month, September, we celebrated the 400th anniversary of Lutheranism in North America. A little group of Danish explorers made their way into Hudson Bay and had found themselves trapped, for all intents and purposes, by the rough conditions, and prepared themselves for an even rougher winter to come in 1619. And so when you talk about Lutherans in the colonial period, we were right there with Jamestown, you know, within a decade or so of Jamestown, and even predating the Puritans who arrived in Mass in 1628, and right about the same time as the Pilgrims at Plymouth. So Lutherans have been around, but not in the same kind of numbers as other traditions, but we've been around almost from the beginning.
How would you introduce us to Henry Melchior Muhlenberg?
He is a remarkable fellow. We call him the patriarch of American Lutheranism. And as I like to tell my students at the seminary, this was not due to the fact that he was a profound theologian, that he produced the kinds of books that we're still reading today. In fact, you'd be very hard-pressed to find more than a handful of people who spend a significant amount of time reading the things that Muhlenberg wrote. He wasn't that kind of a leader, but he was a great networker, and he also recognized the unique circumstances that the emerging American situation offered in the middle part of the 1700s, and responded in a very astute manner and also very insightful in terms of the context in which he found himself. And so for that reason, because of his networking and his administrative savvy, we remember him as the founder of the first Lutheran Synod, functioning Lutheran Synod in North America, the Pennsylvania Ministerium, which was founded in 1748.
So what do we know about his life before coming to the colonies?
He has a great story in any number of ways, actually. He was born in Germany, one of the German states, of course, Hanover, and later on was orphaned, and as a result, it didn't look like he'd be able to pursue pastoral ministry, but as a little bit older student, he actually did study at the University of Göttingen and graduated, finished his studies in 1738. He was born in 1711, so this put him at the ripe old age for this period of time of 27. Most of his colleagues would have been in their early 20s if they were getting towards the old, you know, crossing over the peak of the hill, they would have been pushing 25. But he was 27, so he was over the hill and even beginning to slide down and on the other side. As was the case, once he finished his studies, he waited for a call, and that was pretty typical at the time, that you would wait 3, maybe 5, maybe even as many as 7 years before you would find a congregation open up and be willing to take you on as a pastor. And so he did what guys most often did, and that is he tutored some wealthy families and waited for something to develop. Well, what developed in his case personally was a very deep interest in missions. And he had really kind of settled in his own heart and mind on going to India as a missionary. This had been something that was rather exotic and had been carried out already in the first part of the 1700s, and he saw himself in that kind of tradition. But it didn't, the opportunity simply didn't present itself. So after a few years of tutoring, in 1741, as a matter of fact, he was first approached about the possibility of going to America in 1742. That was realized, and he came to the colonies via England and began his ministry. It was always seen, at least, I shouldn't say always, initially it was seen as a temporary kind of thing, that he would be serving here in North America for a few years, and then he would, if he did well, be able to fulfill his dream of serving in India. But having arrived here in 1742, he stayed for the remainder of his life, and he died on October 7th, 1787. So long, 45-year ministry here in North America, that he anticipated, at least initially, would be somewhere between 2, 3, 4 years, something like that. So quite a remarkable individual in that regard.
Why the province of Pennsylvania?
Great question. Pennsylvania was unique in many ways. When it had been established as a province in the first place, the leadership was carried out by a Quaker, an English Quaker, by the name of William Penn, and hence Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods, if you will. As a Quaker, he was still experiencing, in the early 1680s, persecution back home in England. And so one of the things that he established with Pennsylvania here in North America was freedom of religion, freedom for any Christian tradition to function according to its conscience. And so Pennsylvania became the point of entry for a lot, an awful lot of traditions. And you had the development in Pennsylvania of not only the Quakers, of course, they kind of became the political powerhouse of the province, but you had other traditions as well that began really to flourish in the religious freedom that that Pennsylvania offered. And that would include, for example, Presbyterians, but especially Lutherans. After 1683, with the establishment of Germantown on the northwest side of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you had a point toward which emigrants from Germany could make their way. And so beginning in the 1680s and then continuing with ebbs and flows. Up to the time of the American Revolution, you had some pretty significant immigration going on. And the main point of people coming in was Philadelphia, and then from there they'd go into the collar counties around Philly, and west, you know, to the extreme west, what's today around Lancaster or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, bumping up against the mountains, and then sliding down into Maryland and Virginia and the like. And again, what was considered back then in the mid or early 1700s, the extreme west.
So what kind of a place was Pennsylvania, the colony, when he arrived there?
Yeah, it's a great question. The you already had this, a more diversified setting than you had in the other colonies. New England, for example, the New England colonies, as we know so well, had their established churches, the Puritan churches, Congregational Church. And other colonies had the established Church of England, what today we know as the Episcopal Church. So you had these established churches in which public funds were used to support pastoral salaries, to build churches and maintain churches and the like. None of that was the case in Pennsylvania. You had much more religious freedom, and the result was that all kinds of groups came there, as I mentioned just before, including some really kind of off-the-wall groups. And here's where Muhlenberg's story gets pretty interesting. He saw himself as part of the Pietist tradition within the Lutheran Church, more broadly speaking. And he, in fact, was sent in 1742 to Pennsylvania by the institutions at Halle. And by this time, the leader of those institutions was Gotthilf August Franke, the son of the great founder, August Hermann Franke. And Muhlenberg was very much supportive of the Pietist tradition, Philip Schwaner, the Frankes, etc. However, he was part of a more churchly, for lack of a better word, a more, dare I say it, confessionally oriented form of Pietism than some of the other forms. And this is one of the inherent problems, I think, of Pietism. When the movement began to explode in the last part of the 1600s, one of the criticisms of the state churches, of the established churches, was that they weren't delivering in terms of making a difference in people's lives and actual behavior and the like. That they, you know, the Lutherans had preached justification and the like, but they hadn't emphasized sanctification enough. Well, that was kind of a common theme within Pietism. But within Pietism itself, you had some folks that began to say about other Pietists, you haven't gone far enough. So if Luther didn't go far enough, now Schwaner hadn't gone far enough, and even Franke and crew haven't gone far enough either. And one of the leading figures in this regard was a man by the name of Nicholas Ludwig Graf von Zinzendorf. Typically, we call him Nicholas Zinzendorf. And Zinzendorf had come to America with the purpose of establishing what he called a congregation of God in the Spirit. That is, he wanted to unite all Christians around a basic minimalist confession of Jesus. And for him, that meant finding rest in the wounds and blood of Jesus. If you said Jesus is Lord, that was enough. That was it. And so Zinzendorf had come here to America already in 1741 and begun to, he was striving to make this happen, this congregation of God and the Spirit happen. And that's what got the people at Halle interested in sending Muhlenberg to America. So they sent another Pietist, a different kind of Pietist, you might say, to compete with the more radical Pietism of Zinzendorf. And that person, of course, was Muhlenberg. So Muhlenberg comes in, and he has to confront what we would typically say was a fellow Pietist, but they had different perspectives on what the church was about, how it operated, the place of the Lutheran confessions, etc. There were all sorts of differences. And so Muhlenberg comes in with this more, again, for lack of a better word, conservative form of Pietism, a more churchly, more confessionally oriented form of Pietism than Zinzendorf. And the two really just have to confront one another. And Muhlenberg's successful confrontation over against Zinzendorf in the latter part of 1742 is really what leads to him becoming such a significant leader in American Lutheranism and ultimately being called what we call him, namely the Patriarch of American Lutheranism.
What was the Pennsylvania ministerium you mentioned before?
So, yeah, and that's where this all then will play out. Muhlenberg was concerned over two extremes, as he saw, that there was another pastor, a man by the name of Wilhelm Christoph Birkenmeier, a Lutheran pastor in the Hudson River Valley, who was very confessionally oriented. Birkenmeier was a tremendous figure in the early history of Lutheranism in America, arrived here in America in 1725, so 17 years before Muhlenberg did. And carrying out his ministry, he actually tried to start the first Lutheran Synod in America in 1735, but even though it met one time and garnered a couple more signatures over time to its constitution, it never really functioned as a synod. But what characterized his thinking was this very, very robust confessionalism. So strong emphasis on the Augsburg Confession, but the rest of the Lutheran confessions as well. And the whole idea that these are what are critical for Lutheran identity. Then on the other side, you have Zinzendorf doing his Congregation of God and the Spirit and kind of turning everything into a more nebulous kind of ecumenical minimalism. And what Muhlenberg tried to do was shoot the gap between the two of them. And to do that, to make that effective here in the American scene, he then worked with other pastors to establish, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, in August 1748 specifically, the Pennsylvania Ministerium. And he wanted to avoid an extreme kind of orthodoxy that he would have seen in Birkenmeier, but at the same time, an entirely nebulous spiritualism that he would have seen in a Zinzendorf. And so he worked to straddle that fence and both those traditions in the idea of finding a middle ground for the sake of the future of Lutheranism in America. Now, the way that played out was the Pennsylvania Ministerium would train pastors. They actually hoped to start a seminary. They weren't successful doing that, even though Muhlenberg bought property to start one at one point. But they did have the apprenticeship approach to training pastors. They also later on would provide a model constitution for local congregations, which congregations hadn't had previous to this time, in which congregations would promise only to use pastors who were approved by the ministerium, the Pennsylvania Ministerium, and that they would only use the liturgy that had been agreed upon by the pastors of the ministerium. So to bring some order out of the chaos, but not falling into what he would have seen as kind of an orthodox legalism. And that straddling that Muhlenberg carried out was successful, and Pennsylvania became the biggest, most powerful of the synods and played an enormous role in shaping the history of American Lutheranism from its founding in 1748 until it was finally absorbed into the Lutheran Church in America, the old LCA, in 1962.
Do we know where Muhlenberg stood with regard to the movement for colonial independence and eventually war with Great Britain?
Yes, we do. One of the things that we have, even though he was not a technical theologian and didn't write carefully constructed pieces on theological topics and the like, he did keep a journal over the course of his ministry here in America. And that journal then shows us the way that he interacted with people and with politics and with everything here in America. So it's a marvelous resource. It's been translated into English. And if you're up for that kind of what can be a little bit dry at times reading, nevertheless, I find it rather fascinating. But then again, I am a nerd historian. So, to the point, what we find in that was he was deeply uncomfortable with the notion of revolution in the first place. He had been sent to America under the auspices of Halle, but with the approval of Michael Ziegenhagen, who happened to be the court preacher in England for the English kings, who at this point in time were part of the Hanoverian line. You can hear the German background there. And George I, George II, and yes, even George III gave approval to the Lutheran ministry occurring here in America. And so Muhlenberg said, how can we bite the hand that feeds us, if you will? How can we rebel against that which allows us to proclaim the gospel and to administer the sacraments? At the same time, however, he had three sons, the oldest of which, John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, first was a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, and then later on had to have his credentials renewed by the Church of England because he was serving in Western Virginia, where the established church, the Church of England, was present. This kind of irked him. And so as the move towards revolution kind of geared up, in 1775, he actually gave an appeal in the midst of a sermon, as the story goes, to his parishioners and said, there's a time to pray and a time to fight, and now's the time to fight. Who's with me to fight against the tyrant King George? And off he went. So father and son had very, very different kind of perspectives regarding the American Revolution. For Muhlenberg's part, he mitigated those by, you know, initially very resistant, then kind of moving to the middle in the midst of the revolution itself. He was actually disenfranchised by Pennsylvania. They wouldn't allow him to vote. And then at the end of the Revolutionary War, he said, well, I guess God has allowed a new country to come into existence. He made his peace with the new Commonwealth and was restored in terms of the franchise as well. So in time, he came to deal with it. But his sons were always much more on the cutting edge of American revolutionary thought. So the whole Muhlenberg family in Pennsylvania, they are really quite a remarkable bunch when it comes to the revolutionary period.
Finally, with about 30 seconds here, Larry, how would you summarize Muhlenberg's legacy for American Lutheranism?
Yeah, well, he did remarkable things in terms of interpreting his circumstances and creating a polity, a way of addressing the reality of a church independent of the state. He was the first to do that in a successful way. Theologically, he had a number of shortcomings that were really, in many ways, problematic. But nevertheless, the work that he did in terms of organizing the Lutheran Church in America would set the stage for Lutheranism to have a huge impact on the future of American religion.
Dr. Larry Rast is President and Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Larry, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
We'll be going through listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line on the other side of the break. Then we're going to spend hour two of Issues Etc. with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, continuing our series on the books of the Bible today, the Gospel of John.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
You're invited to Oktoberfest featuring the Waterloo German Band, Friday night, October 18th at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. Oktoberfest features a traditional German buffet dinner, silent and oral auctions, and of course, beer. Tickets are $15. Attendance is limited to 200. Proceeds benefit St. Paul Lutheran School, the only classical Lutheran school in Greater St. Louis. Learn more and purchase tickets at school.stpaulhamel.org. Oktoberfest is sponsored in part by Valo Floor Covering, Alton Memorial Hospital, Bunker Hill Chiropractic Clinic and Bunker Hill Physical Therapy, Hoxie Hollow LLC, Be Dry and Be Wet Solutions, and Steve Schmidt Auto. Oktoberfest, Friday night, October 18th at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois.